The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grey Cricketer Podcast. The Ashes, it's done. My initial thoughts, not that anyone's asked just yet, is that thank fuck that's over. But we will be wrapping up the Sydney Test match and the Ashes in general. And of course, there's some speculation going around that everyone in Australian cricket hates each other. Re Glenn Maxwell, re Matt Renshaw, re Steve Smith. Jackson Bird is on the show and we are really pumped to be talking to someone who's actually played in this Ashes series, so we'll get his opinion on the MCG pitch more than anything else, but of course the Ashes series as a whole. And then of course friend of the show Ryan Carter is talking to us about batting for change. My name is Ian Higgins and I am joined by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards, and boys, the test matches are done. We don't have to put up with any more dull cricket pitches in Australia for a little bit.
Fuck me, he goes. Cricket's a funny game, but I have not laughed in weeks. The MCG ruined it for me, and it didn't get much better in Sydney, did it? Although maybe marginally better, to be fair, but it was just grim. Wasn't it? The fucking Marshes turning up, Smith runs, Usman finding form, the Poms getting stuck in the heat for 65 days or however long it seemed. Joe Root sick as fuck, sleeping through the ceremony. We said that England were going to get alphaed here, but I don't think any of us could have imagined the extent of that alphaing. It was just diabolical.
G'day, Higos. G'day, Dave. I take a different view. I'm going to be honest. I've tried to be highbrow about the Ashes for a couple of weeks and kind of deride the terrible alphaing of the Australian side. But one thing that's happening over here in London is that nobody wants to talk about the cricket. Nobody is talking. Nobody's talking to me. Nobody's really talking in the media. It's done. Everyone's just back on the Premier League. And all I think is, like, that's a coping mechanism. Because if this series was close, or if England had won, or, which is my main point, if England win in 2019, you will not hear the end of it. You will not hear it. Like, honestly, we will be hammered verbally, maybe not physically, in 2019, if and when England sneak, you know, a 3-1 or a 3-2 victory. And so for that reason, I think that Australia's 8-0 win in this Ashes series is something that we should at least observe ritualistically with some verbal crowing. I mean, this was like an Australian side that actually found some humility and patience, something they didn't have last year when they got rolled for however many in Hobart. They've also found identity, you know, the alphaing. They combine those two things better than I've ever seen before. They've evolved as a side. Joe Root, and, you know, respect to his dehydration and the actual medical issue he had, the English captain was literally asleep when Australia won. This couldn't have gone better for Australia. We have to acknowledge that, don't we? We can't be ungrateful about it. It was almost perfect.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right, Pez. From like a playing perspective, like it couldn't have gone any better. But like I'm doing this from like a perspective of like someone who enjoys watching, you know, good cricket. I think about that South African series where it was going around corners in Adelaide and it was seaming off the deck in Hobart. And Australian cricket's their solution to that was, well, we're never putting any grass on anything ever again.
Yeah,
and we're just going to make everything flat. I don't care if matches go for 5 days. We're just going to bat. England are going to have Tom Curran and Mason Crane bowling 50 overs each, and we're just going to bat. And we're just going to stick them out, and we win 4-0. So, like, I mean, from an actual cricket perspective, which is what I'm, you know, basing my hate for this series on, it was absolutely diabolical. But yeah, from results business, I mean, like, absolutely perfect. You know, more or less.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose two different things. Like, I guess what I worry about is that, like, you know, the affluenza of Australia means that, like, things can be so good and, like, our wicket can be so good as a figure of speech that, like, we start, you know, getting ungrateful about the results and we start thinking about, you know, the entertainment value of things.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, well, we win. That's all fine. But I want it to entertain me as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I promise you, like, if England serve up stereotypical English wickets in 2019, wickets that do not play to our strengths, and they win the Ashes 4-0, I promise you they will not be saying, yeah, but the cricket wasn't great. Was it?
No, the English, they don't care how they win. Mm. They're all about just outcomes. And you see that in the way they've played all their sports, rugby specifically. You know, it's all about just nudging up the field, three-point penalty. Just getting there, winning a game without scoring a fucking try. That's English rugby. And it's English cricket in a way. And the result is all that matters. I don't think there has ever been an English whitewash of Australia 5-0, because they don't need to whitewash us. We need to whitewash them.
They did that
200 years
ago.
We have this visceral feeling. Yeah, well, they've already whitewashed half of the world.
God.
Maybe that's what they did.
All right, so let's,
that's good.
Got out of the system.
What have you guys made about the Sunday of the Sydney Test match, the day before, when it was Sydney, part of Sydney was the hottest place on earth, literally. It was 47 point something degrees. I think it was Dan Brettig who tweeted during the Sydney Test match that out in the middle it was like 57 degrees out in the middle or something. I mean, what do you guys think? Like, when is too hot? When do they need to stop playing the cricket?
When people start passing out and stuff. Like, I remember the last game I played, actually, Pez, you were involved when we filled in for Gideon Hayes Yarras when he extended an invitation for us a couple of years ago. And the umpire fainted. He was walking off the field. He was probably in his 60s, to be fair, but he walked off and he looked like he was taking a turn for the worse, and he kind of started making his way towards it wasn't a pavilion because there was no change rooms, just the hill that we're on, and he just kind of went in like a kind of a parabola. He kind of swayed around the place, and I actually thought that he was going to keel over and die. And I think that was the moment I realised cricket, you just shouldn't play it in extreme heat. When a bloke looks like he's about to die, and that happened in the test as well, I think that's just evidence that the game shouldn't be played in those conditions, because the bloke's about to die.
Yeah, I suppose safety is paramount, and avoiding death is paramount. I remember that game as well, Dave, because we turned up as an invitation from Gideon, and both you and I immediately, when this question of heat came into play, having not played the game for 5 years, you'd imagine that we'd be quite excited to get out there and kind of indulge in an old pastime. But like, as soon as there was the option of not playing, that reflex for both of us kicked in. It was like, yeah, no, it's too hot. Like, we were probably fine to play, but like, no, don't want to play. Like, just the anxiety lifted. Yeah.
You know, do you reckon they're going to call it off? Like, who do we call? Like, I was wondering what the hotline would be. There's no hotline. You just had to go to the ground. You had to go down Punt Road across from the north side where we lived all the way over to Como Park. And in 44 degree temperatures.
So it's interesting, because over the weekend, Melbourne grade cricket, actually all club cricket in Melbourne, was called off because it was over 40 degrees. And I believe 40 degrees is the new cutoff for all club cricket. It's just too hot if the forecast is for then. So like, but for international cricketers, like, I mean, the heat obviously contributed to Joe Root obviously being extremely dehydrated, but it was also like he was his affliction. You know, he was otherwise unwell with a virus. The heat, as I say, contributed. But like, so I mean, professionally, right. Are we saying that if it's like above 40 degrees, they just don't play? Is that what we're saying?
I don't know. It's not like tennis, is it? Like in tennis, if that happens, they go off. But
yeah.
In tennis, you can have a reasonable knowledge about like how much activity each player is going to do. Whereas in cricket, it's a bit different, isn't it? Like you don't know how long batsmen will be at the crease. You don't know, like, bowlers can't anticipate how long they'll be able to bowl for. If you can't go on, you can come off. Fielders are generally pretty passive, so it's just a bit harder to be able to call it out. And unfortunately for Joe Root, he had that perfect storm of, firstly having a psychological trauma of being 4-0 down, 3-0 down in the series, soon to be 4. Mm. He was sick, and he happened to be out in the field all day. So, that was... I don't know if you have to call the game off on account of that, or sort of abandoned play.
I guess in tennis, there's you've got the court surface, which probably attracts more heat or reflects more heat off it than like a grassy oval like cricket. But the fucking pitch had no grass on it, so it would have been like a road out there, literally. So that's probably why I got heat stroke. Basically,
so
playing on bitumen.
To that end, I found the most fascinating thing about this test match was that Steve Smith didn't score 100. He got 83 in the first innings. I mean, Australia only batted once, but he didn't score 100. Usman Khawaja, 170. You know, Mitch Marsh scored another 100. Sean Marsh, another 100. So, this Sydney Test match, I mean, did you guys enjoy? I mean, like our experience, Dave, you and I were lucky enough to go into the press box. Some people have tuned into the podcasts saying that we did that. But I mean, like my thoughts were when we got to the press box that everyone was just knackered. Everyone was just like over this series. I think like as soon as Perth was done, like, and it was 3-0. And then Melbourne happened, and there was just a dull test match. And then, like, not even a whitewash could happen. I think people got to Sydney, it was just like, this is just, let's just get through the next 5 days and let's just go back home. Like, did you get that sense as well, Lettos?
Yeah, for sure, mate. I mean, it was like being on, like, a 32-day Kentucky tour, and you're, like, getting to, like, days 28, 29, and you've done half of Europe, you've had 1,000 circuits, you've drunk every alcoholic drink imaginable, and you're just fucking knackered by the end of it. You don't want to do anything. That was the vibe I got in the press box, just tired, emotional people. They've watched so much cricket, you know, over the past few months. Some of them have been in Australia, like Will McPherson, friend of the podcast, has been here since October, just following cricket around. And the cricket hasn't been that great. So you could really, not from him, he's a perennially exuberant character, but the energy of the box in general was certainly somewhat down on last time we were there, which was against Pakistan. It wasn't a very exciting series either. But, you know, is a five-test series, is five tests too many? Is that too much test cricket?
Well, when it's dull, I mean, keep in mind that all test matches went 5 days as well. So, like, it's 25 days of test cricket. And for the most part, there was no interest in the fourth innings except for Adelaide when a run chase was on. But apart from that, it's been a long series. So, I mean, to that end, let's wrap up the Ashes as a whole. Maybe I'll start with you, Pez. I mean, what were your overall impressions of the Ashes this year in Australia, 17-18 Ashes?
God, it's such a big question. I think that... I think as Australians, we are quite conditioned to expect our team to be very good, you know, to be one of the best teams in the world, if not the best, particularly if you were born in the mid-80s and your first experiences of the Australian cricket team were, you know, that they were immortals. We go into every series thinking that, you know, we have a very good side. But the truth of it was that, you know, England have done better away from home than we've done better away from home. You know, in the last, if you were born after the 2000s, you would have seen England win more Ashes series in Australia. Last year, we lost to South Africa at home and had a batting crisis. We lost to India leading into it. We lost a test match to Bangladesh. So there was every reason to think going into this series that Australia were vulnerable. And that narrative kind of still played out throughout the series. You know, a lot of the English press was still asking questions of the Australian side and had this sort of overarching feeling that Australia were there for the taking if only England could kind of capitalise. But I actually think that Australia have... been underrated for what they achieved this series with all of that context. I mean, they've essentially put together a side that has one of the most thorough, like, comprehensive fast bowling units we've ever produced. Bowling units, I should say. Nathan Lyon has elevated himself to a world-class finger spinner, probably the best finger spinner Australia's produced. Steve Smith had... So every sort of summer or three, the Australian captain produces a golden summer. Right, you know, Clark did it, Ponting did it, and then this was Smith's. You know, Smith's the cream on his cake of batting summers. And it was as good a golden summer as I've seen, you know. So you've got this kind of worldie in your side. And then you've got the other guys around him who contributed greatly, you know, and Mitchell Marsh elevated his game. I mean, it was just thorough. And then the selectors were perfect, you know, in what they did. Like, everything they did was just... fantastic, and they annihilated England. So my takeaway from the series is that, like, I think Australia is deserving of a lot of credit. They're probably not getting a lot of it as well, because we've gone back into just expecting Australia to be good when actually previous to this they weren't.
Edo's impressions on the Ashes this year.
That's a terrific summary by Pez. We were better than we all expected. I mean, we were crowing 5-0, 6-0 before the series started, but just the comprehensiveness of it, you know, just the sheer dominance, the runs, the fact that Steve Smith never looked like getting out, and we just kept talking about how he was as good as Bradman, and that wasn't even just a ridiculous hyperbole. Like, he literally was averaging 150-odd at some point during the Ashes series. And just doesn't ever look like getting out. And when you've got that kind of guy there captaining and batting in the top order and just making all the right moves, and a decent team around him, not brilliant, but, you know, very good. And the bowling, as Pez said, is world-class at the moment. So impeccable bowling unit. you know, a captain at the peak of his powers and some good support around him with the bat. And then we're just kind of stopgapping, aren't we? He's 6 and 7. Are we okay there? We brought in Payne. He produced. People are talking about him as being a long-term keeping option now. We hadn't even thought about him before the series started in earnest. But now he's certainly there and potentially for the long term. And yeah, as you say, the selectors really did make all the right moves. We laugh about them a lot. It was this time last year or a bit before that the selectors were in free fall and we're having an extraordinary general meeting about the future of the selection team. I think they were in a crisis of their own. So they've really pulled out all the moves this series. And this is probably the most earnest I've ever been on a podcast. And can we get to something a little bit more stupid now?
Well, I'm uncomfortable.
I was just thinking how well you guys have just wrapped up the series so well. But I mean, and you've spoken very earnestly about how Australia have performed. I'm just thinking, like, just again, putting my entertainment cap on, because you guys can you know, praise Australia all you like, but I want entertainment, because I was, you know, it's just my generation. But and I'm thinking, like, this whole series was down to fucking Ben Stokes. Like, the second that he wasn't going to come, like, you can imagine, you put Ben Stokes in that lineup and that solves so many problems. Like, Perth doesn't happen. The batting collapse doesn't happen in Perth, you know. Extra bowling in Adelaide. Runs in Adelaide as well. The same thing in Brisbane. I mean, England won 4 tosses in this Ashes and they've lost 4-0. You know, they threw one of those tosses away by bowling first in Adelaide and Australia got 400. But I'm just thinking as well, like, there's not much more that could have gone wrong for England in this series. Obviously, Ben Stokes hasn't before the tour. You got the Bairstow thing, you got the Duckett thing as well. But then, of course, they picked Jake Ball for the first test match, who doesn't perform well, takes 1 wicket. Then they play Overton, and all of a sudden he looks like he's the best bowler. Then he cracks his ribs. So, I mean, it's kind of remarkable. I mean, Joe Root as well, he scored all those 50s and no 100s. He just couldn't convert. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that didn't go quite well for England. So I'm just thinking, like, if much more could have gone wrong for them. But at the same time, like, they've actually done well. They haven't capitulated. They've managed to produce 25 days of test cricket. But I just blame this whole... the boringness of this series is, for me, completely down to Ben Stokes.
Yeah, he fucked up, didn't he?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that if Stokes was part of the series that England would have fared better in certain situations because he's a fantastic player. But, like, I wouldn't let them totally off the hook with that excuse. I will say, to be fair to Will McPherson, I was doing a separate podcast with him before the series and he was asked how the series will be remembered. And he said, I think it will be remembered as a what if, which is essentially what you've just said there. He goes, you know, what if Stokes was there? I do think that does a little bit of a disservice to all the great things Australia did. And a lot of the things you mentioned there around things that went wrong for England were a result of Australia putting pressure on as well. You know, Jake Ball just not being able to do it against those guys. The Joe Root conversion thing is an interesting conversation. You know, 50 and 100, they're kind of arbitrary numbers that cricket imposes, yes. You know, as milestones. I think the main thing with Root was that as the guy who was there, like, you know, LeBron to our Curry, you know, to Steve Smith, he couldn't, like, it's about batsmen deciding games with the bat. And so he did get all of these 80s and 50s and 60s and stuff, but batsmen who were the best in the side need to have one or two tests where their one innings does it. You know, it doesn't really matter what the score is. It's probably going to be above 100, but there needs to be some gluttonous innings or two to decide a test to make sure that team doesn't lose. He couldn't produce it. That's down to Australia as well, you know.
He scored 30 points in the game, but he didn't take over in the fourth quarter.
wasn't clutch. Good point. I mean, one more thing before we get back to some actual comedy, but just to highlight how amazing it was for England to actually win here in 10-11. So Steve Smith scored 680 runs in this series, 670 runs at about 137 or something. Just a phenomenal series. Alistair Cook in 2010-11 scored 760 in the same amount of innings. Just to go, like, that is just absolutely, like, that series he had is absolutely phenomenal, which also highlights that even including that series, he's only averaged about 30 in all Ashes series. So that aside, I just want to put one more thing to you guys. A podium that Australia celebrated the Ashes victory on. What the fuck was that?
Oh, it was disgusting, wasn't it? I think we're going to maybe ask Jackson Bird about this later. He's probably the closest to it of all of us. Well, definitely since he's part of the Australian cricket team. But what are we trying to achieve there? We have won the series convincingly, but it's just a little bit of icing on the cake, isn't it? Like, and who's producing that Who's producing these inflatable hands? Who's? Well, what meeting is this? Like, I have so many questions about how this was drummed up as an idea or an ideation, as they talk about in marketing. Like, who came up with this concept and thought it would be a good, prudent move to put on the stage there just at the conclusion of the series?
I mean, you guys like must have been part of some kind of press box conversation about this, because like literally like every writer has lost their mind over this these inflatable hands. Like from the outside, it definitely looked garish and, you know, totally aligned with Australian cultural ideas, i.e., you know, not very smart. but like it wasn't. I just think like in the like realm of all of the garish things Australian cricket does, like, this isn't particularly bad.
But is it because it's an Ashes series? No, like, it is, as Ashes sit above other series? Like, if this was done in, like, a generic Australia versus, New Zealand at home, and we did that, and you saw the New Zealand flag on the clenched fist and the Australian two fingers up, because it would only be a two-test series. I mean, would there be the same reaction? Probably not.
There's no doubt there wouldn't be. And I think to answer your question, Dave, like my imagination of what would have happened when they were in their ideation phase as a marketing team was that whoever is the head of marketing would have stood in front of a whiteboard or had maybe had a Prezi presentation and there would have been one word in the middle, and that was alpha. and you know, maybe a circle around it, because what emanated from there was the hashtag Beat England. The dog whistle throughout the whole Ashes series was alpha, 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 as we said, and then that actually culminated in that 4-0 hand signal. So they were trying to just align their tactics and their initiatives. Alpha was the brand essence. That's why Pat Cummins came on the show and said he would bowl round the wicket bouncers all series. Yeah. And he did. Yeah. And he was a leading wicket taker. And he alphaed.
Yep.
But he lied to us. No man can. So to that end, speaking of alphas, there's been some chat just moving forward towards the one dayers that are coming up next, that Glenn Maxwell is in the side. That's a fact. That's not just some chat. That is a fact. He's replacing Chris Lynn into the side, who is injured yet again, unfortunately for him. But the chat is that, the relationship between Steve Smith and Glenn Maxwell isn't good after Steve Smith said that he needs to train smarter. This is sort of on the back of like the Matt Renshaw thing after he was dropped. There's some speculation that Steve Smith picks his mates. Have you guys any interest in the sort of Glenn Maxwell v Steve Smith anger? Is there anything to it?
Oh, well, you pick your mates, don't you? You definitely, if you got the opportunity to pick your friends in your cricket team, then you're going to do that. I always did that.
I can't add any more. That's the thing. That's what Dave always did when he was skipper. And I think that's pretty. That is probably
at the bottom of the ladder every year. But playing with your mates, though.
Playing with your mates. All right. Well, up next, Ryan Carter's. Following up that, Jackson Bird.
Big day? No, big night. I've got to clean up the last two wickets, sing the song, do the covers, sing the song, drink 42 beers in the sheds, have a shower, sing the song, publicly objectify my teammates' rigs, compare sizes, tell everyone how good I was when I was 17, go to a strip club, lie to my wife, then spend all of Sunday being an emotionally absent father and husband. Big nights start with grade cricket. Lying to yourself has never been harder.
Lads, the bloke we've got on the line is a guy we caught up with last year, former Sydney Sixers star, New South Wales representative, Victoria representative, and to many people's minds, probably the smartest guy in Australian cricket. He's now out of it, though, and doing stuff far more important than that. I'm of course talking about Ryan Carter. Ryan, welcome back to the Great Cricketer Podcast.
Nice to be back with you, Great Cricketer.
That's even better.
It's all
than
talking
the,
unison.
The start you came up with last year when you were talking about a bus driver champing you. So, but no surprises there. I wanted to ask Ryan to start off. The question that's on everyone's lips is, how good is it to be out of cricket?
Well, a lot of it, some aspects of it are good. There are some things that I miss. When I look at some of the older commentators, it seems as though the game is dead easy to them and they forget exactly what it's like to actually suffer the failures and the slings and arrows of cricket on a daily basis. But it doesn't take long. Now I've been out of the game for a while, I turn on the Big Bash and think, oh, it can't be that hard. Why don't I just, you know, why didn't I just hit more sixes? Or why wasn't I the next Shane Watson? It's amazing how quickly you forget about
everything.
Difficulties and just get rose-tinted glasses on everything, including your own abilities.
Magenta-tinted glasses. Mate, you did leave the game at the absolute peak of your powers. Like, there must have been mentally wrestling with that. I mean, I know you've got a lot of important things that we'll get to in a moment. But, like, when you kind of had to go in and talk to the coach and your teammates, how did that kind of play out? And what was the immediate reaction?
Everyone was actually really supportive of my decision. I think it did come as a surprise to some that I retired from first-class cricket at 26, but I also think others probably weren't that surprised because they knew I had other interests and things I wanted to develop in my career. But, you know, whether they were surprised or not, everyone was extremely supportive and, I guess thanked me for being a part of their cricketing experience and wished me all the best. So it was really touching, actually. I didn't maybe expect that level of support. It's really kind.
Karts, did you just get sick of batting? Like, I'm just trying to think of, like, I mean, your last innings was in a first grade grand final here in Sydney where you faced, I think on My Cricket it says you faced 842 balls for 100 and you saved the game and Sydney Uni therefore won the grand final. But it's also, of course, like the probably one of the highlights of your career playing for Australia A, opening the batting with Aaron Finch, where you basically you defeated cricket and certainly New Zealand cricket by opening the batting and scoring, putting on 500 with him. And then when New Zealand came out to bat, they said, "We don't want to have a bat on this wicket." So, like, what I'm asking is, like, did you just beat cricket? Did you just get sick of batting and then you just stopped?
Well, the scary thing is that you're comment about 840 balls for a century is only a slight exaggeration of what actually happened. and that worries even me, who's an old-fashioned purist who likes to try and bat for as long as possible. I didn't get sick of batting. I wish I was so good that I got sick of batting. It was more like when the few times I actually made a start, I wanted to capitalise as much as possible. I don't know. I did, looking back on it, have some... Sorry about that dog barking.
Apologise for someone else's dog.
That's one you can cut out. Sorry to you guys about that dog. I guess I did have a few really long innings. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was a bit of conservatism. When I finally got through a really difficult period, I wanted to do everything I could to keep batting, knowing that those chances don't come along too often. But, if only I got sick of cricket and that was the reason, because I was too good at batting. If anything, it was probably the opposite.
I recall from actually a previous podcast we did, Karts, that you're now down in Melbourne, but you used to live right next to the SCG and used to ride your bike to training. So I guess that after quitting cricket, did you just sell that property because you got no need for it?
Are you talking about the house or the bike?
Both of them, just got rid of everything.
We're talking about property.
can't have a conversation without property for Sydney-based people.
Nah.
Like,
yeah.
I was renting in Paddington, so I'm not there anymore. No need to pay those kind of high tariffs when you're not training at the SCG. So I'm now down in Melbourne, the much, much more livable and cheaper city.
As we can see, Ryan, as the audience can hear, you know, you can talk about tariffs and slings and arrows and reflect with depth about your time playing cricket, but you're now doing something inarguably much more important than that. You're in charge of Batting for Change, which is a charity you've looked after for a couple of years now. I mean, can you remind us about Batting for Change? Tell the audience what it's about and what your plans are with it, in the immediate future.
Of course. So Batting for Change is a charity I founded 4 years ago now, in the middle of my career, in partnership with the LBW Trust. And they're a Sydney-based charity who support education projects for disadvantaged young women right across the developing cricket-playing world. So I'm really proud that across the last 4 years, we've been able to raise over $800,000, which has allowed us to support close to 2,000 disadvantaged students in India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Kenya. But what we're doing right now, we've got our major fundraising campaign for this summer. It's culminating in the Batting for Change Cup, which the Sixers and Thunder play off for this Saturday night at the SCG. And we're asking people to go on to battingforchange.com.au, make online donations, Our goal is to raise $100,000, which could support 300 more students. But in order to get there, we need another 25 grand in the next 2 days. So it's going to be a close one, and any help would be greatly appreciated.
Oh, man, that that elevator pitch is hot. You got that down, Carlo. Yeah. And can we...
Great cricketers just opening their wallets as we speak.
Yeah, exactly. I am. Can I ask, Karts?
Any great cricketers who are on, you know, a couple of hundred bucks for a Saturday, feel free to get involved.
How did you come to, I guess, want to support this cause or make this kind of... Yeah, like, you know, change with disadvantaged women in the countries that you mentioned.
Well, if you look across the cricket-playing world, there's just so much inequality. It's terrifying, really, and completely unfair. Basically, the lottery of who your parents are determines a lot. If you're born in the slums of New Delhi or Mumbai, you'll be lucky if your family has a dollar per day to provide for what you need. And if you're lucky enough to be born with an Australian passport... We have such great social services, great public education. It's not that there aren't problems to overcome, but the problems are really on a different magnitude. So it was really my travels around the cricket-playing world, which I was lucky enough to do when I was playing for Victoria and again for New South Wales, that opened my eyes to all this and made me want to try and make a difference and hopefully inspire a few others to join.
Yeah, Karts, I mean, I remember when we caught up last year, I remember having a fascinating chat with you about politics in the Brexit-Trump era. Are we kind of witnessing, I mean, with many of the projects you're going on, obviously a lot of passion for it, are we witnessing the birth of a political career here, the first cricketer-turned-politician since Imran Khan? If so, what's your policy on the Mancad?
Well, the first thing I'd do if I became Prime Minister is outlaw the Mancad. I'd also, my second act would be to make leg buys illegal. And then I might turn attention to, you know, some really important things like social and economic policy and national security. But after that.
But on that, first, on a serious tone, is that something you're actually kind of looking towards in the future?
No, probably not. I mean, I'm very interested in politics and something I follow, but it looks like a pretty tough game to be involved in. I don't think it's something I personally want to throw my hat in the ring for. Maybe I'll support others one day who are having a crack.
Cuts, batting for change, you've got to be absolutely stoked with how well it's been supported, not necessarily by the Australian public, although that's been huge, but just more specifically within the Big Bash and the Australian cricket community. You've got to be absolutely, like, almost gobsmacked by how well it's been received and how heavily it's been supported within the Australian cricket community.
Yeah, I've been really touched by the support of Australian cricketers, teammates at Sydney Sixers and previously the Sydney Thunder. A lot of guys have done, and girls, Alyssa Healer is one of our ambassadors, so a lot of the cricket guys and girls have done anything from showing up for one of our events to give a Q&A, or Stephen O'Keefe, when he was touring India last year with the Australian Test team, visited our project in Mumbai and met a lot of the women who a lot of his work as an ambassador had helped to support. So it has been really touching about the way the community's rallied behind this cause. And it's been a good lesson that if you want to start something, you go for it, and you can sometimes be amazed by what people will do to help you out. Mm.
Karts, and just to like the what's happening right now, you've got I can see you've sort of replaced the pledge per six model. So previously it was every six hit equated to a certain amount of money to batting for change. You've changed that. There's a pre-match party at the SCG taking place in a couple of days as this goes to air. Do you just want to tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we decided to move along from the pledge per six model and actually get people to show up at the stadium and have a big party to celebrate the cause and make a statement that hopefully gets a bit of television coverage that people who love the Big Bash are also caring about this issue of women's education and want to stand up and get noticed. So there'll be 300 people there on the night. Unfortunately, it's sold out now, so no new tickets available, but we'll all be having a good time on the tennis courts and then in the stands wearing our Batting for Change t-shirts, creating a bit of fanfare, and hopefully lots of people will decide to donate at battingforchange.com.au in support.
Fantastic. You know, Karts, I know you've been what would the word be? You've ducked and weaved the question of whether you'll be a politician, but I'm sure in a couple of days we're going to see you on air speaking in a very statesmanlike manner, as you have here on this show. And it will beg the question from people: Carter's for PM. You know, there have been stranger elevations to positions of leadership in Western nations than that. So we look forward to subtly getting behind that campaign. But more soon than that, battingforchange.com.au, get your wallets out, Grade Cricketers. We'll be doing that. All the best for that cause, Karts, and all the best for your future political career.
Great to chat, guys. Thanks a lot.
It has been referred to as the best sports writing tribute to a particular sport since Fever Pitch.
Does it do anything to enhance literature? Would be another question.
I wouldn't even call it literature, really.
Lads, are very excited about this one. We got an Instagram DM an hour ago confirming this guest, and it meant we had to bump somebody else, which is just a standard alphaing. But it's good to actually do that yourself sometimes. The guy we've got on the line, 278 first-class wickets, best of 7 for 45. Of course, we're all numbers here, and we're going to be talking about my cricket later. Importantly, a guy very much involved in the Australian setup. He averages just under 30 with the ball. I'm, of course, talking about Jackson Bird. Jacko, welcome to the Grade Cricketer.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We normally start the same way, Jacko, but it's gonna be different this week. Higos is going to lead off with the first question. It's a special one. Higos.
You've really pumped that up unnecessarily. But Jackson, obviously you recall that we played together in the under sixes at Wakehurst Cricket Club, our very first cricket club. So, I mean, usually, as Sam says, that we do start about grain cricket. But before then, Wakehurst Cricket Club. So you sort of grew up in the Northern Beaches.
Yeah, I did. So I grew up in French's Forest and Forestville. I played all my junior cricket at Wakehurst Redbacks. And then... yeah, played school cricket after that for a really rough play on Saturday. So, but yeah, most of my junior cricket at Wakehurst Redbacks and Manly Cricket Club.
What was a young Ian Higgins like? Do you remember? What were your fond memories of Higgins? Was he a promising young batsman, or do you just not remember him at all?
No, I can't really remember who I played with back
that long ago. He's joking. He's having a laugh. He's joking. I was tweeting. That was in 1992.
I did last week, so. I struggled for 10 years, I reckon.
So. Yeah. I was going to ask, Jacko, you were just saying you played your school cricket at Riverview as well. You know, it's a constant subject of conversation here, the kind of division between private school boys and public school boys. I mean, did you find, a lot of barriers there as a private school boy making it all the way to the top of Australian cricket? Or is it just you and Ed Cowan, you know? Are you outliers or what?
I think certainly in New South Wales we're outliers. I think traditionally a lot of, first-class cricketers and international cricketers haven't gone to private schools. But I think guys from the outer states, I think there's a lot more private school boys. But I think, you probably get labelled as being pretty soft by the non-private school boys and the older guys. They think you're all silver spoon and all that sort of stuff. So that's probably perception of private school boys. It's not always the case. But a lot of the times it probably is the case.
Well, Jacko, you are talking to three private school boys, so...
Yeah, I think that's probably the only obstacle. You still get the same opportunities as everyone else does. So
I want to know the difference between what was your first grade game? I presume it was for Manly. So, you would have played the very nice GPS grounds here in Sydney from Riverview. What was your first experience of grade cricket?
The first experience for grade cricket, I think I was filling in for fifth grade in during the Greenshield season. We played, I think we were playing at the Union of New South Wales ground, the second ground. Much atmosphere.
David Phillips.
I think that's the one, yep. no wickets and hit back, so it was a wasted Saturday.
Is this, have I got this right, Jacko, were you originally at Bankstown and then went to Manly. So essentially we're at the club of the War Brothers, and then made a move to the Beaches for lifestyle purposes, like everyone.
I grew up playing for Manly, and I had probably had 3 years of grade cricket at Manly after I left school, and then I moved to Bankstown. I wasn't really playing that much first grade, and you know, I was sort of going out on the circuit in Manly rather than actually playing cricket. So I did a bubble down there. It's hard to escape. So I moved to Bankstown for a bit more opportunity. That, you know, they were pretty good about giving me a go in first grade, and then started taking a few wickets consistently, and then I ended up going back to Manly for a season before I moved down to Tassie.
So. How many times would you say you got featured in the Manly Daily as a young man?
A few, yeah. It's, it's pretty funny newspaper. You know, you get asked a lot of questions and then you read the quotes and you haven't said any of that. So turned around a fair bit, so obviously the great supporter of Manly Cricket Club, and two of the Manly boys get featured quite regularly.
So in terms of your playing development, sounds like you've actually sort of developed a little bit later than others, but I mean, tell us like how hard it was for you to leave New South Wales to head down to Tassie. Was that a tough decision to make?
I wouldn't say it was a tough decision to make. You know, I felt like I wasn't going to get an opportunity in New South Wales. There's a lot of guys that were just sort of starting to debut, like guys like Cummo and Hazelwood, Stark, you know, Kemp, Trent Copeland, Doug were all taking lots of wickets at that time as well. So, I think when I got offered the contract at Tassie, I didn't think twice. It was a good opportunity. They won the Shield the year before. You know, the wicket was really green back then as well. So, I always thought it was good enough to play for Tassie, but I just lacked the opportunity. And, you know, I was pretty happy to get that with Tasmania. So, in the end, it was a pretty easy decision to make.
And I think it was a justified decision because I believe you took 53 wickets at 16 in that first season.
roughly,
player of the season. Do you miss Cargo Bar?
No. To be honest, I actually played about 4 years, so.
Did you?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm allowed back in.
Upstairs or downstairs?
No, I used to work upstairs.
Is there a downstairs? Oh, right.
Yeah. Is there a downstairs, Dave?
I didn't know there was a downstairs.
Down in the town. Yeah.
And so.
I don't think it's too much, to be honest.
Jacko, from your time in Tasmania where you just took loads and loads of wickets, you know, through to your elevation into the Australian team. Can you just give us a flavour of what it's like to get that call to be picked for Australia and just to generally be involved in the Australian setup?
Yeah, well, I got the call from John Inverarity. It was pretty sort of daunting. I mean, in the moment I sort of put the phone down, I was kind of like, shit, I might actually have to play. Yeah, I got nervous instantly. So, and I got another call not long after that from the bowling coach, and he said, I think we're resting Starkey, so, you know, get ready to, you know, prepare to play. So, it was sort of about an hour to myself in my room, and, you know, it was pretty, a surreal experience, really. So, it's always great to be around the Australian team. You know, Test cricket's still the pinnacle of cricket, so it's bloody hard work, but it's pretty rewarding when, you know, you have success as a team or individually.
So, Jacko, let's take it all the way up until this Ashes series, and you obviously played in the MCG Test match. I think it's been well documented. I think it's been accepted across all boards, up all the way up to the ICC, that the pitch was shit, everything about it was shit. What was the chat in the dressing rooms about the state of the wicket?
The wicket was pretty flat. I think it's the flattest wicket I've ever played cricket on. any wicket I've ever played on, other than just in Test cricket. You know, the MCG usually has a bit more bounce than that, and you can still get blokes out if the wicket's not doing as much. But, you know, everyone was on the same page in terms of their thoughts of the wicket. It wasn't up to standard, and it just wasn't exciting as well. So, I was having a bit of a laugh. It was a good one to come in for. So.
Yeah. I know. It was very unforgiving for you, wasn't it? Like, you know, every cricket team, I'm sure, like all the way up to the very top, has someone who whinges about the wicket the most, though. I mean, are you prepared on the Grey Cricketer podcast to give any insight, you know, as to who was blowing up the most in the change rooms about the wicket? Who was just saying, this is fucking shit?
Yeah, the three quicks in March, two were talking about it pretty often. But, no, it's just one of those things that you've just got to get on with it, really. So, you know, there's a few remarks here and there saying how flat it was and all that sort of stuff. But
fair enough. I think, yeah. The MCG really has copped it, though, hasn't it? The MCG really has copped it, and we probably don't need to lay into it anymore from a Sydney-based interview. But I wanted to ask you, Jacko, there's so much talk when you play cricket in Australia about how important it is to be able to bowl 140s and how important it is to be hostile and to be able to, you know, intimidate batsmen and stuff like that. You know, as a bowler very much from the old school who, you know, would just be so successful in such a range of wickets around the world, you know, like, does it frustrate you that so much of the thinking here is just, and by here I mean Australia, is about just the necessity of being able to just notch it up to 150Ks all the time?
Yeah. Oh, look, I'd love to be able to bowl that fast if I could, but, you know, I can't, so I'm not going to keep doing it now. And I think historically you don't have to bowl 150Ks an hour to take wickets in Test cricket. So, you know, it'd be nice to have the option of being able to go up a gear and, have that same airspeed as some of the other guys. But, you know, I just... Yeah, it's not something I'm ever going to have. So, you know, there's other things in my game that I just need to be consistent at, and that's basically just bowling line and length. So,
like your batting, as Rod Marsh said.
No, I had a few nosebleeds in the test match batting at number 9. I don't think I'll ever be a number 9 test batter. So that was pretty funny. But no, I've actually been hitting the ball pretty well. I've got a new stance, like Smithy, stepping across. Seems to stop my pace getting blown off. By the MCG this year, which already got me out, LB. I would have thought you might have been
influenced by George Bailey's kind of Ned Flanders reverse stance being down in Tasmania.
I don't understand how that works. You wouldn't be able to. You must have a sore neck every now and again from that.
But I want to ask you, I mean, Jimmy Anderson, I think it was before the MCG test match, he sort of questioned about Australia's, the depth of the bowling stocks. And then, I mean, I'd imagine that you would have been pretty fired up to prove him wrong. And obviously the state of the wicket, we've already talked about that. But, I mean, how did Jimmy Anderson's comments make you feel when he said that, you know, aside from the three big quicks, you know, Australia hasn't got much after that?
It doesn't really bother me at all, to be honest. He's entitled to his opinion. I'm not really sure how much field cricket that Jimmy watches on the live stream from Manchester, but so I'm not really sure how much influence he's got on our bowlers. Look, he's entitled to his opinion. So, I thought when he was coming out to bat, I was thinking, right, I'm going to So Jimmy and I tried to bowl him a bouncer and I got just above the knee roll, so I couldn't really get that.
Showed him.
Like I said, he's entitled to his opinion and,
It's a shit opinion, and disrespectful one, but we'll say that. Jacko, you know, it was a hard-fought series, in terms of the personal battles that were taking place and... you know, I guess it's fair to say it was Australia steamrolled England. I mean, can you give us an insight into sort of relations between the teams after the series? I mean, you know, was there a beer or would there have been a beer? Is there a circuit? Do you wait until the end of the one-day series to do all that sort of stuff? I mean, like, you know, what is the relationship between the teams off the field?
Yeah, I think the relationship's fine off the field. The English guys came into the change rooms, I think, and had a few beers after the last day. I was actually down in Hobart for Big Bash, so I didn't get to celebrate. But, I think the relationship between the players is fine. The boys had a pretty big circuit on Monday night, and then we had a few beers yesterday as well. So it's been a good couple of days. And then now the boys will all just go into ODI mode now and get ready for their first game on Sunday, I think. So,
do you guys often do you guys often laugh about the way that the media writes up these kind of interactions between the two teams, both on and off the field? I mean, it sounds like there is some mutual respect on both sides. I mean, do you guys kind of get together and go, what's going on with the media?
Yeah, it's pretty funny reading some of the media stories, to be honest. Like, you know, sometimes you read them and just think, shit, how did this person actually think this is true, you know? So that's sort of fun.
Yeah, Manly Daily.
Pretty funny, so... Yeah. Yeah. So, no, we don't really take too much notice of what the media says. I think a few boys are pretty big readers of the papers and stuff like that, but I know a lot of the guys don't even bother anymore. So,
media, why do you even bother?
Just jump straight into the great cricketer Twitter feed, obviously. Bertie, you've now played Ashes Test matches both here and abroad. I want to know the difference between, you know, sort of fielding in front of the Barmy Army or as opposed to, you know, fielding in England. Like, is it a little bit more hostile almost fielding in front of the Barmy Army here, or is it? Do you sort of cop a bit more flak fielding on the boundary in England?
Well, that was pretty. It was a pretty long hour for me fielding in front of the Barmy Army the other day. I think there was 10,000 blokes all singing that other shit. So that's pretty funny. I think in England you get sledged a little bit, but their sledges are usually quite witty and quite funny. Whereas in Australia, when you get sledged, it's pretty. You know, they abuse you. So that's more of the Australian thing. Not the domestic circuit doing the big bash and stuff like that. So I think. Yeah, the English fans definitely are more witty, and their sledges are actually pretty funny, whereas some of the Australian sledges, not much thought goes into it. They just try and abuse you as much as they can.
Well, Jacko, it's that time. It's throwdowns time, and I kind of hesitate to call it that because, you know, given your... you're sort of rank as the guy that's tended to be helping out the Australian side in the last little while. I'm sure you've given your fair share of throwdowns, so it's your time to actually receive a few. We'll ask you the question. Hopefully the joke's wrapped in the question, and if it's not funny, we'll pretty much find out fairly soon with the silence, or I'll just delete it so no one will know it ever happened. I'll kick it off, Jacko. We did cover a fair few of mine, so I've not got many, but... When Rod Marsh did famously say that you'd missed out on the side because of your batting, I thought that was kind of the breakup equivalent of "it's not you, it's me." Were you tempted to show him your My Cricket stats, which I've looked up, which reveal your highest score's 39, and also tell him you're capable of making 40-odd?
Yeah, I had to ask him to repeat what he said to me when he told me that. And then it was kind of funny. It was before a day-night test, so I had to go and get in the car with Danny's son, and who was a coach of Tassie at the time, and said, "I'm not in the test side because of my batting." I said, "Your dad's lost it." And then he goes, "All right, I'll have to give him a ring to clarify." Yeah, I just think good communication. Yeah. There was a bit of a breakdown in the communication, so.
Yeah, comms error there. Jacko. Yep. One from me. You've got a Bachelor of Business specialising in marketing. I'm just wondering what your take is on Cricket Australia's giant pair of inflatable hands, which they unveiled at the post-series ceremony. Is this shrewd marketing strategy or idiotic fuck-up?
Yeah, I'm not sure where that's come from, because I actually don't have a Bachelor in business, so I haven't...
Wikipedia.
So I was like, no, I've got to pull out of this one. So I'm not very good with numbers. But I actually had a bit of a laugh at that. I thought that was pretty funny. I'm not sure who came up with it, but
I
think it was a little bit. So,
Bertie, your brother takes photos for the Sydney Sixers and also, of course, for Manly Cricket Club. Does he have any photos of me in the under-sixes for the Wake Coast Redbacks? Because I need to change my Facebook profile picture.
I can ask him. I think my mum was a coach of one of those teams, so I think I'll probably ask
Correct.
Him. He's probably got a few photos lying around, I reckon. So.
Perfect.
Bertie, I actually remember coming across you as a 12-year-old at the Talented Athlete Program in Narrabeen. I remember a bunch of us conspired to bowl a series of bounces at you in the nets because you were younger and better than us, I think. Anyway, is that where you got your fear of the short ball?
My fear of the short ball? It's actually I actually like it when they bowl short at me because usually if they bowl it at the stump, they'll get me out. So.
And just a follow-up to that, Bertie, do you remember Dave?
I remember a few blokes gave me a hard time on that camp. I can't remember who that was. That was a long time.
I was just one of several people that bullied you, yeah.
Thanks
for that. look at where we are now.
Well, Bertie, this is an ordinary one. Look, everybody loves a lazy pun. But I just wanted to know how many times you've seen the headline "Bird is the word" and whether you've just had enough. Because I have.
Yeah, I have definitely. So it's not funny anymore. I don't think it was ever funny. So they don't say it as much as they used to, though. My last name's pretty good for a headline in terms of. A pun or whatever,
Just a question about your teammates down in Tassie. Which one would you say is least likely to enjoy a weekend excursion to Mona followed by a wine tasting at a boutique Hobart vineyard?
I reckon James Faulkner wouldn't really like the museum. I don't think he'd have much idea of what's going on in there. But he'd certainly enjoy drinking all the wine, though. So.
Winery first.
Yeah. I think Sam Rainbird's not very cultured, so he'll. I think he really enjoys the museum too much. Sorry, Rain.
Bertie, just to continue on the theme of this whole interview, which is do you remember us, but we actually played against each other in a PGs game at Manly Oval, and you bowled the first ball to me and it just went through to the keeper, and then you ran down the wicket and you looked me dead in the eyes and you said, just watch out for that crack halfway down the wicket, and I did, and the next ball was a half volley on middle and you bowled me. Why didn't you try that at the MCG?
Was I hungover that day? I can't really remember much.
Hungover every time you met me, guys.
Just really wasting your Sundays. Nah.
Thanks for being a good sport with that, Jacko. That was a real hodgepodge of questions, and I'm pretty sure the title of this show is going to be "Do You Remember Me?" And also thanks for confirming that no, you do not remember any of us. Please don't apologise.
I'm trying.
Mate, thanks for coming on the show. All the best for the rest of the summer. Well done on the Ashes success, and I'm sure you guys will get them in 2019 as well.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, mate.
Have a good one.
Oh, look, I haven't changed my point of view on the matter. I said what I said a few years ago, and I guess at the moment he's obviously trying to sell a book, so it's amazing how more and more of the story comes out.
So are you two mates?
I think that's a bit of a stretch to say that we're mates.
Well, that's certainly what he's been saying.
Yeah, look, I think, as I said before, it's a bit of a stretch of the imagination, given that we've hardly spoken about since it all happened, and obviously haven't played since, you know, he took over as captain. But anyway, that's all old news now. So, as I said, I think it's more about him trying to promote his book through the summer.
Terrific to have Jackson Bird on the podcast. Welcome back to the Grade Cricketer podcast. And Higos has actually had to leave the episode for now, but stick with us. Pez and myself are still with you. He's gone to record the Bill and Boz show on Fox Sports, representing us, clearly a rig-based selection there.
Without a doubt.
But he does have the best rig of us. Anyway, we're here for Ask TGC, our favourite part of the podcast where we answer your questions. You can get us, as always, Twitter, Facebook and Instagram apparently as well. So this first one comes from Joe Lundy, Pez. And he says, I don't normally ask important life questions of a fictional cricketer who tells jokes on the internet, but the Christmas period has taken its toll and I have nowhere else to turn. My sunglasses are on the bottom of the Indian Ocean and I need to purchase some new ones before my county cricket fixtures resume. They no longer make my old Ray-Bans. I have a terrible eye for fashion, am not good enough to wear speed dealers, and I want to avoid the nickname Mum Sunnies for the rest of the season. Better to get the new pair and risk derision, or just suffer the searing pain of fielding in 40-degree heat and glare with bare eyes. Advice, please.
Thanks for the question, Joe. I'm impressed for starters because obviously we bang on a lot about the things in cricket that make us anxious. That's pretty much the basis of this whole thing, how cricket manifests in casual anxiety for men and make comedy of that to cope with it. I've never heard of anxiety over the purchase of sunnies, though. I mean, this is one thing where I feel like I can alpha this and go like, oh, I can't believe you're worried about sunnies. And then the second question I've got is, second comment really is like, do people wear Ray-Bans on the field nowadays? Like Ray-Bans are obviously quite a fashionable thing. Like when I played, because it's, time's getting on now, when I played, like there was pretty much one strand of cricket sunglass fashion and that was the speed dealers. Although they weren't known as speed dealers then. They were basically just the Mark Waugh, Dean Jones sunnies, weren't they? Thoughts?
Yeah. yeah, well, I actually think I probably did wear some Ray-Bans at some point, but I was a bit of a rare unit, and you know that more better than anyone. But I don't think... I mean, what's he said here? He said, they no longer make my old Ray-Bans. So he was wearing Ray-Bans on the field. Mm. He's not good enough to wear speed dealer sunglasses in his own eyes. So I think he just needs to get the new pair and risk derision. I think he's obviously committed to the Ray-Bans brand. And he's not good enough to wear the Bolle sunglasses that Mark Waugh popularised et al. So I think he's just going to have to go fork out 300. I think it's about 300 these days. What in pounds, what would that be?
150, 160.
170. Yeah, yeah. So, mate, grab the new pair of Ray-Bans and because you can't risk.
Just
you can't risk that.
Yeah, you can't risk your eyes. I think you've got to risk derision. I think there's an element of playing cricket everywhere where you... You risk derision. I mean, that's the name of our next book.
I mean, one thing I just noticed, why are his sunglasses on the bottom of the Indian Ocean? Was he on a boat or is he just like wading out and he's kind of lost them?
I presume he's either on the like the east coast of the US or the west coast of Australia. And he's dropped them. He might be catching on an expedition, a sailing expedition of some description. Kevin Purnell, can I take this one, Dave? I mean, this is a new format, isn't it? Isn't here.
Yeah.
This could be a bit wild. Kevin Purnell writes, Dear TGC, tonight I was drinking in a bar in Bangkok, reading Tea and No Sympathy. I came to the section where the protagonist is batting naked, albeit with full kit, in the mirror. All of a sudden... and this is inverted commas, the next imaginary ball shaped away and did me for bounce. I lost my shit. A well-meaning Frenchman with an attractive girlfriend seemed amused by this. As things panned out, I got drunk with a nice bloke from Cornwall with rat's tail dreads down to his ass, some very questionable tattoos and a series of stories with very inconsistent timelines. My question is this. What is the best response to the two blokes who drive past the ground every Saturday, drop down a gear in their 2009 Japanese hatchback and scream, "How's that?" Cheers, Kieran.
I wasn't expecting him to, you know, it started with such a global setting and he's taken it back to just a fucking grim suburban setting. Blokes that drive past the ground, dip the window down and scream, "How's that?"
I just wonder whether any of that preluding context was relevant to the question.
I don't think
and
it was.
The answer is
but,
yes,
but
because it was the best part.
Yeah, we're touched by it. Thank you for that, Kevin. But what do you do? I mean, because Pez, we've obviously heard this ad nauseum as cricketers. You're there, you're fielding, you're on the fine leg boundary or wherever you are, and blokes come past in their 1993 Subaru or 2009 Japanese hatchback, as he says, and scream, "How's that?" The most lowbrow fucking thing that they can think of while they're on their way to the beach. Did you ever... What are you thinking in your mind when that happens?
I'm thinking, normally what happens is I turn around when you hear it and...
You want to get an optic on them.
you want to get an optic, want to see what they're doing. They're normally holding a Slurpee of some description. There's normally some bad servo sunnies from one or two of them. You can normally hear howls of laughter in the back of the car because it's normally sort of four blokes on the way to the beach.
The boot isn't quite closed because there's a surfboard protruding from it with rope around the boot to keep the boot closed.
Exactly. And you turn around wanting, you know, the wittiest, sharpest reply you can, and you go to speak or yell something back, but your voice catches because you've got nothing to say. You've got a half arm raise going, and
they're already halfway to Coogee.
By then the car's gone and you get lost in the dread of existentialist thought about whether you should be at the beach or playing cricket.
And then you turn around to the cricket match and the ball's already been delivered and the ball, so the blokes hit the ball wide of square leg and now you're lost. Like, you have to run to the ball and get it and you're fearful that you've shamed yourself in front of your teammates.
Exactly. You hear and then you sort of hear this kind of, because when you're running in cricket to get the ball, everyone's screaming instructions at you, but you can't hear anything because the wind's in your ears, but everyone still screams it anyway. But you can sort of faintly make out a captain going, "Oh, fuck's sake," or something. And you go to pick up the ball, you fumble it. Anyway, that's what I think.
And then the ball drops just short of the keeper and fucking it glares from everywhere. Fucking throws up.
Keeper tries to take it on the half volley and it just sort of ricochets off the hand so that the person backing up has to get it. The keeper doesn't turn. He just looks at you glaring.
Yeah. I think we've written about this before. Mm. This one's from Nathan Hartwell, Pez. He says, "Fellas, firstly, love the show. Secondly, I have a question you could address on the show for me or here." Okay. Should a team lose a DRS review if the on-field umpire does not call a no ball on-field and the video umpire calls a no ball on the replay? It has just happened, of course, to the English and Mason Crane. Cheers, fellas.
I think this is the wrong place for that question. Like, as I'm reading it, I'm like, I don't know what you're saying.
Cricket related question.
Something's happening with DRS. It's not right. We're not happy with it. They want to introduce they're about to introduce that a similar system to the Premier League here in the soccer in the UK. I think they've just started trialing it, and you can hear, you know, the same conversations are taking place about what it does to the game. And like my advice would be, like, just don't let the genie out of the bottle. Don't start. You know, the mistakes that umpires make are just part of the rich tapestry of anger that, you know, cricket produces. And we only play cricket really to express our anger that we feel in other areas of our life. So any question about the DRS will involve me answering. It shouldn't be around.
Okay, we'll move on then. Next one. You want to take this one?
Yeah, okay. Aidan Pawner, P-A-W-N-A, Pawner, writes in saying, "Non-cricket related, lads, but I've just been champed by my mum after posting a weight loss program on Instagram." Wow.
Post.
"How do I carry on after this?" So many questions about how do I carry on. Do I put the weight back on just to get rid of the champ tag or cop it on the multiple chins?
Oh, God. Mate, you've just got to pull your chin up or chins up and cop it from your mum. Well, I don't know. How is she champed? Has she champed him, I guess, in an Instagram comment?
He's posted on Instagram saying, you know, New Year's resolution in 2017 was to lose 10 kilograms. I've done better and lost 13. There'll be a pre and post
new
photo.
Year, new me.
And then mum's written under it, "Well done, champ." There could be some deep-seated stuff there as well. Like, mum could have cooked him a lot of really good food as he was growing up. You know, she might have had anxiety about his weight as a child and wanted to make sure that he was well-fed. And also, she's felt champed by him with the weight loss program, so she's really just getting him back. Yeah, Aidan, I think your mum's just getting you back for you being ungrateful about what she gave you growing up.
Diabetes by cooking too many, you know, delicious baked goods. This one's from Thomas Harris Pez. He says, "G'day, Roosters.
Oh,
as a 20-year-old grade cricketing battler, I used to spray Lynx Africa on my neck as a replacement for an expensive cologne. Looking back, did I have serious issues or was I more alpha than I originally thought? Genuinely baffled."
Never heard of Lynx sprayed on the neck.
I've heard of it sprayed on a lot of body parts, you know, including nether regions, but certainly never the neck as a cologne. Yeah. Obviously, just trying to get, you know, walk past a woman in a bar and just get that whiff of Africa.
Yeah. Yeah, the image of spray-on deodorant applied as cologne to the neck is a very, it's a jarring one for me.
Yeah, I'm just picturing him spraying it and then walking through the spray.
Yeah. I mean, Lynx Africa is traditionally quite like a short, fat bottle, isn't it? It's not one of those like long, like slim Rexona type bottles, are they?
Lynx has rebranded their product line. They've got some interesting ones like musk and ginger, like really weird shit going on now. But I just like Africa. Africa was certainly the most commercially successful of all the different fragrances in the product line, and I can say that with authority.
Was this in, in high school? So just finally, because I always thought the worst Lynx was Lynx Java. Do you remember Lynx Java?
Oh, fucking daddy. Yeah, I do now, but I don't remember the scent of it. It was like Java, like the place.
What, Indonesia?
Just jungular.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the smell of year nine corridors. High school corridors.
Yeah, high school corridors, yeah. I don't know exactly what that is. Pete Wilson. Boys, saw England fielding coach Paul Collingwood MBE at the SCG. Chest, pipes, salad, all top-notch. A far cry from when he played. Any intel? He's asking for intel.
On the salad regime, I presume. Yeah, I've not inquired.
I did see him, and I agree that everything is in. It's looking pretty good. It's all together, like the chest, the pipes, and the salad. They're all in perfect harmony. I don't know if that is a far cry from when he played, because I assume he was one of the more professional players, but I'm just trying to cast my mind back to his salad.
He's definitely got a better rig now than in his playing days. I think in his playing days he was a little bit more wiry, like a good player. You know, don't get me wrong, but he's certainly put more effort into the rig, into kind of beefing up the rig. But also, it is quite taut. And I think there was a number of shots of him. In fact, an alarming number of shots of him all series, generally on the balcony of the English cricket dressing room in a singlet. So he was rocking the training singlet, like with great pride.
I think that's what I did a lot when I finished playing cricket, because you wear restrictive long white clothing for so long, you just embrace not having to wear cricket clothing, like full body clothing on a hot day. So he's probably just relishing being in Australia and wearing a singlet on a 40 degree day, if nothing else.
Yeah, so no great intel, pipes. Really.
But no, we don't have any intel.
Okay. Paddy93 has asked the question that everybody's been asking, or maybe been afraid to ask. He says, is forcing a man who's bordering 90 to scull a beer fucking yuck, or am I just not fun anymore? Hashtag ask TGC. So he's referring to the annual Bob Hawke sculling at the SCG phenomenon, which took place. And it was particularly, but Bob Hawke, age 88, he hovered over that beer for quite a while, to the point where they had to return to play and then back to him to finish the scull. I mean, you were at the ground, Dave. You had the first-hand view. Your thoughts?
Oh, well, look, I think I'm in the camp of saying it's fucking yuck. I mean, I think the first time it was spontaneous and fun, and there was a joie de vie to that. Mm. You know, it was an endearing reminder of the larrikin prime minister that was Paul Keating, still in our hearts. Even to this day, but he is bordering 90, Bob Hawke. Keating. I'd actually like to see Keating scull a beer.
Yeah,
that would actually be much
scull
more enjoyable.
A bottle of Cab Sav.
Grange.
Yeah.
Look, I don't think it's you, Paddy. I think it is a bit of a, I think it's peer pressure. And I think a guy who's captained his country, I was about to say, who's prime ministered his country, led his country for multiple years. I don't know why he's obliged to do this. I'd actually like to see him turn down the opportunity next time. And I did actually see him walking into the elevators, because he was around the press section.
Yeah.
And he was on a frame, and he's actually looking very fragile. As you would at that age. So I don't think we should be pressuring him to smashing schooners from now on. I'd like to
I'm
see
kinda,
that
I'm kind of torn on it, Eddos, because on the one hand, I think if the man wants to do it, he's 88, if he wants to, if he's at home
does he?
Saying, you know, look, I want to do this. This is my thing. This is my jam. Then, you know, by all means, let him do it. But there's also an element of, like, as you said, it was a very kind of spontaneous thing at the start when it first started happening. But I'm reminded of the Travelling Wilburys line, you know, overexposed, commercialised. Like, it is now becoming...
You're always reminded by that.
I'm always calling on Travelling Wilburys lines when I'm thinking about Bob Hawke. But, like, it's sort of becoming a little bit... I'm kind of a bit jaded by it, you know. It's just kind of a bit naff that it keeps happening, and it very much harks back to the idea of just, you know, Australians as drinkers. Bob Hawke, you know, should be known for more than that.
Well, we've seen Turnbull drink schooners as well. Like, you have to drink schooners, and not just when you're in power, but also for many years after leaving power. So I guess it's just part of the Australian political landscape and something that all future leaders will have to get used to. Is that it?
I think that's it. It's been a long show. Thank you for sticking with it. It's been Jackson Bird, Ryan Cardis. If you're still with us, you can still get our book if you want. Somehow you missed out on the great Christmas rush. Steve Smith has won the numbers this year, but we think we can sell more than him. So, take that, Smithy.
Take that. Come on the show, Vince Bradman.
Come on the show, though, please. Bye.
Please.